I think it has the psychohistorically has to do with trying to dominate the other, trying to absorb the other, as Valentine, the Brazilian poet and philosopher said, a sort of anthropophagy. Yes. How to eat the other in a sacred way, to turn the other, to eat the taboo, he said, the local. Yes. So I think our civilization depends on being others. We disguise that as a group, an enterprise, as communicating between cultures, which has a lot of Christian, maybe Christian beliefs behind. I do it. I'm not criticizing you. Nothing about me. So there's a lot of imperialism. If writing is, as we know, imperialistic in nature, translation is more clearly imperialistic. How to gather the other? If we all are still hunters, how we hunt, how the ways we hunt become fixed, and that's how capitalism arises. Once the hunting methods get stuck, repeated. And one of the ways to hunt in a fixed manner is translate. Why do dominant cultures translate so much? The same as gathering oil. Counterculture has a lot to do with beating the other. It's imperialism by other means. So translation, when we understand translation, we need to understand translation also in that context, in the context of a not so innocent and a not so good way to see ourselves. Because as writers and translators, we mostly see ourselves as missionaries, as Christ. We need to get over that. Which is, I think, the most difficult part of writing, losing your own imago as a messianic figure. And translation has a lot to do. Has a lot to do also with suspending your own risk of emptiness and building something from emptiness. So you start to translate others. So translation has also a lot to do with how we renounce the risk of your own work to make you a figure of service to others, which is just projections. We choose to translate whatever we identify with, but we don't want to recognize ourselves there yet. So if writing can be a gathering, imperialism is stopping time and making it space, which American literature is all about that, postmodern and modern American literature is all about transforming space into time, feeling clear, saying also, etc., etc. They even say explicitly. So that's the problem, how to follow writing, stop it as a space, or keeping it transformed into what now I'm calling time. And if we do that, the processes as translation are left behind. Because what we must do as writers, I think, is to transform languages, not to transform a language into a dominant language. That has a lot of myths, beliefs, and lies, that this language has a meaning and I can get across a meaning and put it here. That's the old paradigm about writing. And translation mostly works with that paradigm. So I know that this may sound like, so what to do next? I'm not sure. I'm just like becoming aware of what happens in writing, what happens in translation. And so translation must maybe be a change for learning the other language, the language you want to replace with your own, with a whole set of myths behind that action, and maybe keep your research in that language you got interested in, and writing in it, for example. Or transforming your own language, being active in your own context, and the space, the fixed space, which your language is now, liberated through the teachings you got from the other language. That's what I want to say.
Thank you very much. So since we're going in reverse, it is new.
A study of six in six. It's a provisional title. And the only reason I'm even mentioning it to you at all is that I hope it serves as some kind of glimpse into what I'm up to. A study of six in six, meaning I'm using the actual words of the panel. And actually, I think you might have said something different than what I'm working off of, but the title and the six that I'm referring to are these six words that I think was given on my little green sheet. Translation, moving across borders, languages, cultures. A study of six in six. I'm going to try to, in some sense, address those six words in the six or so minutes that I've allotted to me. So it gives you a frame, gives you a form, gives you a little bit of the motivation, how quickly I think I'll be moving, but why I feel like I need to, in some sense, hit each, at least some part of each word, so that we can promote the conversation between the panelists and you, all of you collectively. By mentioning the title, I'm already starting in a state of translation. That is, I'm beginning in a place without designation, and this is a little bit what I'm picking up from the remarks, that translation, rather than this notion of one-to-one, a kind of portion and equivalence, moving from one to another, what I'd like to question here is the two-ness of the thing. And can we crack it open and invite in a kind of plurality and a multiplicity? Not even a multiplicity, but the very act of pluralizing, okay? Multiplying. So for every noun that I catch myself saying today, I also immediately want to convert it into some kind of verb. And I hope you will do that as well. Even if I don't catch myself doing that, I hope you will be doing that on our behalf altogether. In other words, I'm operating between genres. This is a panel that's usually an institutional format. You know, there are talking heads at the front of the room. And what I'm trying to release here is using convention, using form, but translating it. So I'm already arriving here in a state of translation between discourses, between formats, between occasion, right? Formality, informality, written and spoken, fragment, and whole. The thing that's being presented, and this weird idea that when you're working with translation, there's an original, right? It's a fixed point in language, in time, in history. The original, the problem of the origin. And what I'm trying to enact here, if I can possibly do it, is that as I'm presenting, there's already an elaboration taking place. So can I begin to somehow put that into this public space, this public discourse that I hope we'll be having in a few minutes, So that, as I just said, there's already an elaboration, which is already being further elaborated by the fact that there are all of us here. So how can we get all those parts to function on behalf of what I think translation is, which is the site of something under transfer? I mean, if you really look at the word translation, right? Trans, as in cross, which I'll be talking about in a little bit, because that's one of the six words. I won't say too much more about that. But the latus, L-A-T-U-S, which is the root, so as in like transferred, right? So pay some attention to that notion of translation as transfer. But of course, the minute you say translation, you're thinking translation, trans culture, trans form, transport, trans modify, transmit, transpose, transfigure, translocate, transmute, transmutate, transgress. And I'll start there. Stop there because we could probably do that all afternoon. Transglobal, transimperial. Not to make sure that I always talk about those. But this problem of origin and the problem of equivalence. And if I do nothing else at all, I'd like to pose the question of how immediate for you as writers and readers of literature is that connection between first and second and the demand of equivalence? Because so much of, I think, what language can do is distort and distend that expectation of equivalence, of meaning, of sense, and to be somehow transmutated between one condition and the next is what I hope we can keep in the forefront as we talk. Moving. It's a wonderful word in this context because it stages for me a couple of different concerns. One, history is always on the run. Again, going back or similarly, you know, sort of working at some kind of analogous angle from the notion of fixed origin, I think there's an opportunity here to rethink history as some kind of fixity, a fixed continuum, a chronology, a kind of linear shape onto which we hang experience and shared experience and notions of collectivity. And I'd like to propose here, in fact, that history is always on the run, it's always remaking and reconfiguring itself. So the notion of moving through time, through immediate location, past, and a sense of futurity and of becoming, I also understand as part of what I'm calling the translative condition. So that in moving in time and in history, in thinking and in perception, there's the suddenly emergent. So to be translated or to be in a condition of translation or under translation is in some sense to be able to pay attention to the suddenly emergent, the thing for which there is no name, the ungraspable. Across. It's a pesky preposition, isn't it? Think of all the prepositions you know. They're all very problematic because they try to fix one thing to another. And that's their job, that's their function, that's why they're part of grammatical expectation. But it would be a great exercise for all of you, you know, to think about all the prepositions that you know you're friendly with and really try to figure out what they do, why they're there, why do they exist grammatically. What are they serving in terms of the you know, taxonomical work that we're asking them to do and that they commit on us even if we don't want them to do that to us? So across. A problem because it implies directionality from one to one. Again, we're reducing the problem of dominance and subjugation, one language to the next. Who is the colonizer, who is being colonized? So across already, by implying from where to where, and directionality kicks up this question of placement. So it's a pesky preposition, and look at all your prepositions, because it will tell you a lot about where you're situated in relation to another object, person, thing, time, feeling. Order. Big, juicy, impossible word. Especially because I think there's been so much theorizing about it, especially in the last, what would you say, few decades? Right? So everyone in the room has some kind of take, personal, you know, like as in based in one's own story, to maybe the most like, you know, theoretical discourse you've, you know, been exposed to around the notion of order. So we can't rehearse all of that here. I think my 2 seconds are up anyway. But I will simply mention some concepts that I think will certainly help elaborate how we might talk about order today, and then I'll simply include something that I think might open up. So just this notion of the mix, or the graph, or the border zone, or an other time, or certainly one of the earlier moments of this kind of iteration where the notion of double consciousness, say, the W-E-D-Y, or notions of hybridity, the notion of heterogeneity, the notion of multivalence, and then of course you get into this kind of like counting effect, right? Is it bilingual? Is it multilingual? Is it polylingual? Let's say heteroglossia. Okay, so this clearly puts into some kind of evidence the struggle, useful struggle, and sometimes not so useful struggle I think we've had with conceptions and practices of the border. So I just simply wanted to mention that to you so that you could have that to draw upon. But what I'd like to leave you with on the notion of border is, rather than limit border as boundary, but border as boundary from which something begins to be processed. And that's what I'd like to leave with you in terms of border. Not border as boundary or limit, right? Stopping point. But rather, border as the occasion from something, the occasion from which or out of which something can begin to be presence. Am I way over my 6 minutes? I have no idea. I'll go really quickly through language.
I think you have
2 seconds for language. All right. Here I simply want to propose, how is it possible to think of language unhooked from its normal job as something that advances a nation, right? The ideology of a nation. So language bound to nation, soil, and citizenship. That way of conceiving and practicing language and what that has to do with the kind of political process of domination, subjugation, exclusion. So in relation to that, I guess my question for all of us would be, how is it possible to think of language as an event in time and space and history and perception and affect that has to do with attending to not how it organizes experience, how it normatizes, how it standardizes and regularizes how we come into speech and how we come into thinking, but where the event of language includes anything from silence to speaking to hearing to writing to saying to not saying. Yeah. A lot more to say about that. Culture, well, here we are. Return to sort of the mother load for the week, cultural activism. I'll leave with the 2 questions rather than working with the word itself, because I'm sure I can do that another time. Going through here. What is the activism in cultural activism? As I've been attempting to suggest, activism is not a fixed, monologic state. But if one can think about the potential, the radical potential of the poem, it's the radical potential of language to activate the space of the unpositioned, the untried, and the as yet unavailable to the social historical index. Which part I think?
Activated space on what? Untried.
Untried, unpositioned, the as yet unavailable to social historical index. I'll stop there.
Cecil, you want to go first?
That will occur at some cost to you. you know, as a travel writer, and one hopes, assumes, lands for cost to the reader as well, to the people that you're writing for. It seems to be the second way that conscious, in the second way, conscious travel, conscious thoughtful travel, could be the thing that Taylor Reckon described poetry as being. That is, the long journey out of the self. What I might propose is a couple of open questions. The chief among these, the first among these rather, is how do you reference the other in your work? And here again, I'm bouncing off of previous panelists this afternoon. I bring this up to suggest that there are maybe 100 ways in which we do this, like every day, we as Westerners, which we reference the other every day. And if we can catch 50 of them, we're doing pretty good. I mean, writing as Americans or Westerners, we evoke the other for local color or for the subliminal metaphoric effect that the subaltern's presence might provide. How the presence of a figure with no agency, that's the subaltern, might enhance the Western speaker's own. The black writer Clarence Major, see you guys with Clarence Major? Yes? That's okay. Riley answers this in his long poem about Venice, or Europe. Old Europe surfaces the masks by evoking the image of a cultivated Negro in a country where one does not expect to find him available and speaking many languages, causing one to feel ignorant. The point here is that referencing the other as consciously as possible is something that I think we ought to be doing. And another question which comes up often is, and I heard it in the margins today, what do you call them, whoever them is? What do you call the name? And I would like to use that question as the occasion to posit a bigger question beyond that. When you bring up the them in your writing, how do you use that whole naming issue, that whole messy naming issue to complicate a number to destabilize the status quo, if that's what you're interested in, ongoing. The unstated high position of the West, of blackness. He strikes these main issues in translation, widely defined, representation, translation, consciousness, all the same logo. Papa referenced gypsies yesterday. That those perpetually marginal travelers that we still talk to watch out for. I watched when I was growing up. The travelers with no agency. The brother must have left home without his American Express card. Think of the good old racist verbs, to chip, or to chew. Feel similar. Who can get etymological on gypsy? Anybody? That's what they're talking. Okay. I heard, even though you're not supposed to talk, I heard somebody whisper Egyptians. Yeah, that gets surprised. Yeah, Egyptians, it's a Middle English. Egyptian word for Egyptian, because gypsies were thought to have come from Egypt. They're Africans. That's a name of the West with much derogatory baggage. Gypsy, African. It's all there. If poetic language unsettles things and makes resolution possible by making the message strange, then the conscious traveler will necessarily return the gifts that are unexpected, strange themselves, and telling of wonders. This, of course, being Steve's point from yesterday, but it proving such travel's way of confronting stereotypes and neat little xenophobias. The French, oh, they're hot. Jamaica, Jamaican is dangerous. Jamaica? Jamaicans love that ganja. Jamaica? Jamaicans love catering to the wishes of American visitors. My friend Billy Joe Harris said, the whole poem, neatness matter has nothing to do with the truth. The truth is quite messy, like a wind-blown room. I've been fortunate in my life, in many ways. I've been fortunate that I've been able to encounter the mess that travel is, and that travel's become an important site for me. One of the things I yesterday that this ridiculous fence that the U.S. is building is there in place to keep us in place. Truman's age, I think. It seems to me that subject position is a huge part of conscious travel writing, and that and an important parts of subject position are on the far side of that fence. That's an important part of who we are. Who I am, it's over there, where I'm not supposed to go. If you put a beer into me, two beers into me, I will yammer on and on and on about Canada and the black and white loyalists who fought against George Washington and then went to Nova Scotia and had good lives there, and they're still there. Something appropriate to think about for the 4th of July. But I don't get that much time. This afternoon, let me tell you a brief story of my arrival in the Dooch 20 years ago. Anybody here been to the Dooch? The Dooch? The Dooch? The capital of Liechtenstein? Okay. Yeah. We were in Europe. My wife and our baby daughter, myself, I had some money. I'd be through Europe. And we had just a few days. So we figured we'd go to a really small country. And I've always had a thing for Liechtenstein. So we took the train from France to Sargans in Switzerland, and then the bus into downtown Vaduz. It was a rainy Sunday night. The hotel was full, but I argued with the hotel keeper in my Oberschule Universität Deutsch, and a rule was found. And soon, in a matter of moments, I was downstairs in the hotel restaurant eating sauerkraut, drinking a glass of beer, happy as a clam. But that's the consumer being victorious. That's me using language to get something I want. That's me using language to procure something, a room in a hotel. Of greater and longer lasting interest to me is the incident on the way to the hotel. We were walking in the rain, it was a mile off, and a car stopped and backed up, and the door swung open, and a ride was offered, which we took. My daughter is 1 year old, she's a backpacker. Are you from Africa? The man said in English, no, I said I'm from the United States. I asked where he was from. I am Turkish, he said. He was a dishwasher at a different hotel than the one we were going to be at. That he and I talked briefly, we talked about the work. He let us out, we wished each other well, and I did do well that evening at the hotel, and I did well also, and then I read some more about the Dastar virus, something I knew a little bit about from Dusan Makadejic's movie Montenegro, which some of you have seen, and I just reached into. I was lucky enough as a traveler from a rich country to fall in briefly with a marginal traveler to go along with him in his car in the German-speaking world. And remember that English ain't nothing but Marcello off German. And to be brought up to speed vis-a-vis the complexity of my own identity as once American and colored in a way that many Black Americans are not lucky enough to be aware of. Like I say in my course story, travel is a complex, redefining event. I was redefined that evening in the news. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon. And thank you to my fellow panelists for letting me read last or speak last. I should need to hear what everybody was saying, because the topic is kind of abstract and I could take it many different ways. When I was starting college, I had just gone out of high school, and I grew up on the reservation. Every morning and every evening, I would cross the border, across a physical, cultural, linguistic border. It felt like as I crossed that border, people did different things in the city. And it wasn't a city, it was a small Main Street town called Holbrook. And as I carried that border within me throughout my whole life, and I carry it with me today, I don't know who empowered that border. I don't know if I keep fanning the flames or if I keep it alive and vibrant, because that is my origin, that is my place. I speak both languages. I speak Navajo and I also speak English. And Navajo we call it Nebazar. And so this notion of always having to cross is certainly a part of my own work, and it's certainly a part of the consciousness of many Native people in this country. Our languages are languages of this land. They're the languages that have been sculpted by the land. They're thousands of years old. They're sometimes continuous, and a lot of them are discontinuing as we speak. I feel like one time I was actually walking. I just got out of class, and I was in my first college in Holbrook at this community college, and I just got out of class. And I was sort of walking up the steps towards the dorm. I was carrying my books on my back. It was probably February morning, or maybe March morning, or something. And as I was walking, I heard a voice, and the voice said, Scott, hey, Hagelstein, yeah? I was like, this is, and I was kind of shaking, and I was like, oh, the person said, good afternoon, where are you going? And I kind of looked around. I looked around on both sides of me, and I was like, am I hearing voices? And then, then there was a man, over here watering the grass. And he got up and he was looking at me, and he was a white guy, and he was an older white guy, so I was really confused because he spoke so well. And then he started talking to me in Navajo. The whole conversation we had was in Navajo. He was like, "Oh, how did you come, nah?" And then, "Where are you from?" I'm like, "Oh, they." And I started talking to Navajo, kind of thinking about it. I'm like, "Oh, no, they mean well, they." And then he's like, she has the dumb, they, the what you call it, I grew up in Greece with, my father was a trading postman. And so he lived in Greece all his life. And it was shocking because this guy talked to me in my own language. And I don't know why it was shocking. I don't know, maybe because it's not shocking to the general white population to see me talking English. But it was shocking for me that somebody knew my own language that was a different race. And I was just pleasantly, it was very pleasing, because it was like, oh, you remind me of my grandfather, you know. And then maybe 5 or 6 years later, I had a reading on the other side of the reservation in Farmington. And I gave my reading. And then, again, I heard that voice. God's egg in the audience. Something like, yeah, thank you for speaking. And I was all looking around again, and I was in a sea of Navajos, and I saw this, like, this older white guy waving at me. And then I'm like, and I recognize, like, and he goes, oh, I see, now, Shay Abin, Ashay, man. I guess he didn't remember it was me that he spoke to 5 years ago. Here he was at my poetry reading, several years later, maybe 10 years later, he's right there. And he said, and he was sitting with his wife, and he says, Shay the Nanshan, I'm Navajo. Shay the Nanshan, I'm one of you, or something. And it's all about this embodiment of language. It's all about this idea of what kind of power and what kind of breadth language gives you. And that language itself does not necessarily belong to a certain people. That language is organic, language flows, language is a source of life. In Navajo, we have the concept of Saab. And in Navajo, I was interviewing a lot of poets from my class this week, and I was interviewing a lot of Navajo poets. And I kept saying, what is this? What is the inspiration? Where does your poem, where do your poems come from? And then all of them eventually came out into language. They came out into Sa'd, Hanmat. Sa'd is story, song, and then Hanmat is also story and song. And so this notion of always seeking equivalence between the cultures, of always trying to, you know, negotiate between the oppressors and the oppressed, I just kind of feel that I think it would be very important for, you know, non-native speakers and indigenous speakers of this country to learn and to understand some of those concepts. Because if you can understand, I'm very hopeful, I mean, I'm kind of like an idealist in a sense, if you can understand a certain mountain range, if you can understand the story that has been handed down generations and generations, and really understand those words and what they mean, what the concept is behind the word, what is the spatial, spiritual significance of that place, maybe it wouldn't be so easy for somebody just to plow it down, or maybe it wouldn't be so easy for somebody to sell off the rock for asphalt to be made into freeways. Maybe people would think differently about destroying this piece of place and building houses on it. Because I don't know, because English is sort of an imported language. It sort of, to me, it's able to make everything into objects, and it's able to sort of cruise over the land and put them into acres. So I always think idealistically that it's necessary to try to see wherever, you know, you guys live, what are sort of the local indigenous names of these places, what is the significance of that word. If you go to the East Coast, all the rivers are, you know, Eastern Native words, and does anybody ever think twice about that? Chuksan. It's not Tucson. It's not Tucson. It's Chuksan. And Chuksan is the Hanaakan word, meaning this place. So all of these words in this country are derived from indigenous words, and because this country has been lived upon for thousands and thousands of years. So there's a tendency to create over and to mask over. But to also understand that maybe in the languages of this place, where people have lived for thousands of years, a millennia, their origins are here, maybe for some way we can learn from that process. So, that's it. Thank you.
Rudimentary discussion on translation. We assume that whoever is being translated is incapable of translating himself or herself. But we are sitting on this panel, and at least three of us, I don't know what your situation is, Yanni, at least three of us are capable of self-translating ourselves, right? So even if you're speaking in English, you are perfectly capable of expressing the same. Maybe not the same ideas, but very similar ideas in Navajo. You need to speak. Is your mother tongue Korean?
Yeah.
So that makes four of us here who can meet you in English without being translated. So what is your insight on this problem? Which kind of it certainly proves what you're saying in terms of plurality and multiplicity. But it also kind of debunks the model of translation. So what is your take on this? It's a question from the floor.
I began to write in English and speak in English in order for that not become an object. At the beginning, I had experiences in California where I read Spanish, excited, event, nobody, no real experience, just fantasies. Then a guy reading in English for me, and that repeated until I why am I feeling this way? Every occasion that that happens. And very simple, I'm very in flow. It was because I was an object instead of a subject, instead of many subjects. So I decided not to let anybody speak for me. I could handle English in certain ways. I can destroy English because I have this mixed feeling about English, you know, as a friend, as an enemy, as an ally, as an emperor. So all those feelings come into mind, and I get more exposed. I get into the enemy's territory. And because as writers, we're warriors. So I get into enemy territory, and then a sacred war, or maybe a civil war, that I cannot, can happen. So I would like to emphasize that what happens in between languages, between writing, doesn't follow the models of good, nice experience, but of demonic, emotional, passional. So that was my warrior instinct to go to be a subject and to make a sacred work.
Anyone else? Want to comment on that?
I'm actually still trying to understand the question because I think it's a very complex one.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I'm tracking your question, you're asking to some degree one might have, and in fact might be compelled to act on the agency to speak in the language that is not English. Mm-hmm. I mean, is that partly what you're asking? And why, to some degree, is that not happening?
I mean, my question is simple. It's very simple, maybe I didn't frame it correctly, but we're talking about an other, right? But four of us here are the other.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are making ourselves present here and visible by speaking the language of the other,
mm-hmm.
which it depends on our particular situation,
right.
But I mean, I don't know what the degrees of otherness that we
right.
experience.
Right.
They certainly vary between
right.
us. But what I'm trying to express is, I think in the world today, many people are capable of speaking for themselves in the language that is not their own. And so my question is simply, what does that do to models of translation?
Okay.
What do we do when the other is capable of self-translating him or herself, and what does that do to our position as
right.
culture?
I think I'm glad I asked, because I think for me, the way I interpret that question for myself is that for me, at least given my own autobiography, my Korean, while I feel sort of everyday bilingual, the way that I'm speaking to you, I couldn't do in Korean. So it's degrees of, mother tongue, right? So where are the places where I could, in fact, translate my own agency in this other language, and at least for me, as what traditionally passes for 1.5, like you're
right.
a child and you come to America, mm-hmm. and depending on your linguistic whatever expertise, for me there's a kind of very palpable cap beyond which I can't really go linguistically in Korean. So it's a wonderful question for me in the sense that I can and I can. So in some ways it acts out that ambivalence of the problem of the agency, of being othered,
mm-hmm.
and then does the being othered mean that you have like a grasp of the other, mother tongue? Sometimes it does, and often, I think for a lot of people, it's degrees of command of, or, relation to mother tongue. So I'm kind of a good example of the kind of impossibility in a way,
right.
Or really the problem of people who's working from the other end.
Right. Yeah, and I guess also there's the issue of communication in the sense that the more fluent you are, if your English is perfectly fluent, you are erasing the traces of the other in you. And so what are the politics of that?
Yeah.
Do you consciously manipulate your pronunciation, for instance, to make that otherness visible? And do you control it, or are you a victim of it? And is it a site of resistance? Is there agency in that? Yes.
I always, when I feel like I'm always, when I speak more Navajo, actually I start to talk in English, and the Navajo picks up the English, you know, and it starts to own the English, and vice versa. And it just always is, because I feel very bilingual, although there are some very difficult terms in Navajo that I have to sort of ponder in English codes. And then in the process of translating, I think there's a growing number of very amazing poets writing in English, but they're sort of thinking in their interior language is Navajo. And what they're doing with the English language is actually entering the language and then actually creating some new areas that might not have really been there before. So in a way, it's kind of reversed itself, whereas before it was always a sort of imposition. It was really just sort of beat out of us. I mean, we had to, my grandmother, and then stories about having to, being put just because they didn't speak a hint of Navajo. And then when I got to my generation, we had been thoroughly they almost just vacuumed out of us. And I had to take initiative to try to make that work for me to have to go back to my language. And so, this notion of translating and then we can translate out, I think it's a very empowering place to be. And also in the fact to have this discussion, it would be great to just translate between indigenous languages, just for the mere fact that we always have to use English or Spanish as a model, because we also translate with indigenous people in Colombia and in also in Mexico. So Spanish, these are sort of imperial languages, Western languages, have become sort of our middle place where we began to meet. Eventually, I wonder if we could just go from indigenous to indigenous, or like tribal language to tribal language. I wonder what that would be like. But it would have to take somebody who is bilingual in both languages to actually do that. So right now, it's interesting because we have been working with a Colombian poet, and Alison Hedgehog has an anthology out where our translators were Spanish-speaking poets, bilingual poets. And so they translated. So first it went from the indigenous language, then they translated it into Spanish as a bilingual. And then the Spanish language had to be translated into English. So almost you have that as your agency of translation.
I was urged to add something to that, in terms of the various kinds of English that there is, the vernaculars of English. One thinks of, obviously, African-American vernacular English, so-called lines, all of that, and how, which is also, interestingly, kind of beaten out of black students. Right? It's very, very curious. Everybody hates the box. That whole all the talk around it is profoundly interesting because it leads to questions of social class, which is a huge taboo in the United States as a topic of discussion. What I find myself attracted to, and this relates to some stuff that I think determines what you're saying, is texts that are like really mixed. And the things in terms of African American pack language that I think of are obviously Zora Neale Hurston's work, the Raja Raja Girl, which is written. My students, when I teach the book, complain, why can't I read this? It's hard to read. You can read about that. It makes sense. But it's also written in standard English as well. And the languages mix, they mate with each other, they do some weird stuff. They dance together. It's Africans, the brothers, it's a beautiful dance for the brothers. Gail Jones, the writer, does similar things. I think also of Rolando Cuneyosa Smith, who chunks of his books in Spanish, chunks in English, chunks in Spanish. And it's awkward. It's not easy. It's messy. That's okay.
I'm also thinking of Cecilia Acuña's work, for instance, Edmund Torres, Rodrigo Toscano, Thomas Ligui, that Yes, where the text is permanently being it unsettles itself constantly. And it's marking that rupture.
When you speak a stepmother tongue, at least what happens to me is that I break. I take the code from the other language into me, so it's not outside anymore. And there's an opportunity to end the projections. What you talk was outside, it's not inside. So it's an opportunity to. The sacred word I was referring to is this, if you make myself. And what happens is that the language makes you uncomfortable, and you start to break. What used to flow, mother tongue, doesn't flow anymore. So you feel like doesn't express things that you might say or that word don't think. And what you can realize is that all the fragments that are appearing in front of you, so you realize how many different fragments you are, thanks to that stepmother.
Now, the stepmother tongue in your case imposed or adopted?
No.
Being in Tijuana.
Watching, seeing TV, listening, even, that's still a lot of money, dollars, pesos. The same hand. So,
are dollars currency in Japan?
Yes. They are called gold, pesos, silver.
So, we're being American?
Yeah.
And gold being American?
I'm kind of curious, just a real possible question. I mean, in our own native tongues, when somebody's trying to speak English, do you guys get this sort of internal? I don't know, just this sense of like you're talking about the bottom side of the so, when I was a kid, I would hear other students, like the city students, talking what was poor English around the Navajo students. So they would be like talking like this and then like that, and just like really kind of making fun of them in some sense. But it was also the way that, and I noticed some people, I don't know if we internalize it, like if we speak our own languages and our English might come out a little, it might have some sort of, it might be understood better in the business language or the native language, the home language, and then we translate it into English, and it would appear as poor English. I wonder if we somehow, perpetuate, our own internal colonization, or I don't know if there's another word. I mean, do we perpetuate that ourselves?
I know, for instance, in my case, and maybe, particularly because I grew up in a bilingual household. My mother's American, my father's Mexican, but I grew up in Mexico. So when I was born, my mother didn't speak Spanish. And so my English was very good. But there is this political, even though everybody, a lot of people who go to private schools especially, are taught English in schools, it's mandatory bilingual, of course. Most people have to learn English at some point or another. But it was embarrassing to have a really good English accent. So I would just pretend, I would fake it. And not only that, but also people are subjected to TV commercials, every single radio station is always playing American pop music, etc. And people will say pizza instead of pizza, or una Pepsi. Like there's all these brands that you just voluntarily mispronounce to subvert the order. And it's very small, a very micro little subversion there, but it's kind of empowering. To be constantly shape-shifting is also, I think, interesting. And here, there, and it just constantly avoids the stereotyping. Right? I mean, the easiest way to do it is just by manipulating your pronunciation. You can also be deceiving and manipulative, but that's another matter. Okay, so time for questions from you.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Monica Modi, and thank you, that was just such an amazing panel. I want to right now keep one variable out of this panel topic. I want to keep language out because I write in English, and I want to just talk about moving across borders and cultures. You know, while I'm here in Europa, with certain people, certain groups, and in certain workshops, I'm completely unconscious of being anything other than who I am. I'm conscious of only being Monica Modi, just the way I am. And in certain other groups and in certain other people, I'm very conscious of being this exotic person. And this exotic person can be, and this feeling of being exotic can be anything about it, right, from being completely unfamiliar to them, or sensing a certain kind of quizzicalness from them, or a certain kind of superiority. So, you know, it all varies across these registers. And it's a little disturbing because I think I'm as ordinary and as extraordinary as anybody else in this hall, right? So I just have been thinking about this question, which I think is relevant to everybody in this hall, including myself. So I just want to sort of pose that here, which is that how do we treat somebody who's traveling into our context? You know, what can we, this is relevant to me because I meet a lot of travelers in the city that I stay in. So, and I've been thinking, what does it take? Does it take a certain kind of openness, a generosity, a certain kind of honesty, a certain sensitivity, humility? And in other words, how can we allow every traveler to have agency of their subject position? So I just wanted to say that. Thank you. Thank you.
I think that once one feels exotic, if there's a, we need to be very on the watch for projections, right? So when I feel exotic, it means that I'm causing that feeling to appear there, that I want to take responsibility of it. So it's not a question of, am I allowed to be myself? But a question of how to hunt the projection so that you don't get out of control and things outside start to happen to me, which don't happen to me, which I will make happen to me. So it's all like, yeah, what happens outside is what you desire.
I find it really, sometimes I don't know if I'm being exhausted. So, it's just there. And it's really kind of hard sometimes to, I guess you would know it, but people's ears perk up and when they hear something else. Or they're treating you differently because of who you are and where you come from. And I get that a lot, not just all over the world, you know, but where I travel. It's always a negotiation, I feel like, and you are extraordinary, and I think it's just a way of negotiating and knowing, okay, this is where this has to stop, and this is where I begin, I think people just need to realize that we are ordinary, sometimes very boring people, you know, I think it's hard for people to realize that we are ordinary, people living our daily lives. And I think that it's, in my case, I mean, being native, there's always that, everything has to be either spiritual, always earthy, spiritual world, constantly living, constantly praying for people, And which is not the case, So that kind of weirdness always sort of follows me, especially like at a cemetery, it's all there. But it's indicative of the society, on one hand, we're revered as having this sort of connection to the world and animals and all this stuff. But in another case, I think if people that live close to the reservation really don't like us, because we're so close to them, we're so ordinary.
I think it's important, part of my education, anyway, the last many years, to become acquainted better with the idea that that we all have wings. There may be very ordinary people born, as you say, I could very boring myself in that question. But that, you know, skin color, ethnicity, where we're from, and so forth. What our voices reveal about us, what our accents. You know, as Monica said, we have a two English accent. Oh yeah. That gives a certain weight. That's the word that I find myself using, W-E-I-G-H-T, a certain weight in the world, in various contexts. And that, well, it's no stereotypes about you, the way that one communes with animals, or whatever, or the way that one is, you know, good at dancing. Or not. that's part of your not your subject position, but your description. And knowing your description is something that maybe you need to know. Or helps anyway.
Next question. Alicia Wood. Going along with like translating oneself and when language breaks you, I'm wondering about your all's experiences with writing with multiple languages in a single text and what happens with that.
I'll start. I think for me, surprisingly, it took a long time to actually understand that some of what was appearing in my text as partial sounds, like just sound values, just like a sonic entity, was in fact sometimes like clearly understandable and sort of categorizable as, oh, that could be part of a Korean word. But I think it took me a really long time to filter through, you know, what are the complications of either over-identifying, like that could be bound up to like a Korean entity, but I'm much more interested in not necessarily locating it as such, but having located it as such, what else does it make available in something? In other words, the presence of multiple languages, multiple consciousnesses really, opens up the text to different ways of thinking and hearing and enunciating. So for me, the presence isn't so much a question, as I alluded to earlier, of counting objects. Here's Korean, here's mother tongue, here's my truncated third grade Korean. You know, I mean, one can quantify, you know, and kind of have a working taxonomy of these multiple presences. But for me, the question remains, what gets radicalized from the presence of those parts, things, that don't all belong to each other in any sort of native way, if you will. I'm using that word purposefully.
I think there's too many questions, so do you have an answer specifically to that question? Or should we move on?
Actually, my name is Lynn Graham, and my question was more, I was interested in the idea of like travel and travel writing as a way to kind of alter this idea of otherness, you know? And I was wondering how much the current like issues with travel in the U.S. as far as like the rising prices and airlines and like safety precautions and all that kind of thing is serving to kind of keep us in and kind of preserve this idea of otherness, you know, so that people don't travel outside of the country as often, people don't have this need to learn another language or really go outside of their bubble in a sense. And I guess I wanted to know what your thoughts were on that.
I don't know. I know that gas is expensive, but I remember, I guess before the last holiday, Memorial Day, gas in the East was like about $3.05 a gallon, right? And yet there's still lots of people on the roads. And the radio, you know, National Public Radio, listeners supported National Public Radio, you know, this
survey, like how much did it cost to get the family of four, you know, from New York to Providence on Amtrak, you know, on the airline and on the Greyhound. And still, best part of it is take the car and drive. And, you know, predictably, of course, after Memorial Day, the prices came down. And I guess they found some gas or something. I think that the price of the rising price of stuff is kind of key to what the public's willing to accept and profits stay the same or get better for the oil companies. Are people traveling less?
Outside of the country.
This
kind of is my...
Oh, I see, outside.
Yeah, like the majority of Americans stay in America and even within like driving distance of where they grow up. And I was wondering how much that kind of impacts this idea of otherness. That, you know, within the area that you travel is kind of us and then everybody else is other. And how much, whether or not you're able to travel outside of that area affects that. That sense of
otherness. Because we don't go abroad. If that's true, there's obviously stuff that we're focusing, but I know that it seems to me, as from my experience as, you know, as a teacher, in teaching the classes and of students from various ethnic groups, but the ethnic groups don't really, they're still other to each other.
Yes.
You know, and so we may not have the advantage of seeing actual, quote unquote, actual foreigners, actual Europeans or Africans or South Americans. And yet, there's still a fair amount of travel here, which well, to go back to this lady's question about here, which you're still an exotic. I'm still an exotic in traveling in certain parts of San Francisco and central Pennsylvania where I live, I've been living for the last 10 years or so.
Yeah, what I meant was more how much that lack of connection creates that otherness. How much that lack of seeing people that don't look the same or seeing people that aren't, you know, from your community or whatever affects that idea of otherness.
I think it's huge impact. Absolutely. And so there are rumors, you know, about the other. I know I've spent a lot of time in Canada. And, you know, the kids and white kids in Northern Canada, you don't want to go to Newark, New Jersey, you know, to experience that, to become M&M or something like that. And so that, you know, that lack of knowledge, you can have the description, you can want the description, want the sexy thing that you see on Yale MTV Raps, without the actual confrontation with otherness itself. Again, as people have said, you see stuff on TV. At this point, people of color, if that's what we're talking about, are part of it. For community. That's part of it. It's become a community. It's become part of the lure of the culture. And it may not have anything to do with actual people of color. You know, but it's... But still, there's the representation without agency. All this stuff works together.
Okay. I think we have 7 minutes left, so let's try to speed it up.
Okay. Hi, Alice Martin, here we go. So I think one form of translation that I would like to touch on would be unspoken language, sign language. Language that cannot be heard, because what a burden of translation that is. I have an uncle who's the only hearing member of his family. So for his entire life, he had to translate for the rest of them. He learned how to speak English by watching Saturday morning cartoons. I mean, can you imagine being in this bubble of silence and having to break outside of that, which, you know, is definitely a metaphor for writing. So do you feel, as non-native English speakers, do you feel burdened by translation? I mean, I know you were saying that a lot of the Native American languages are sort of being lost, and that to me seems really sad. Is there a way to preserve those? You know?
I spoke to a linguist a couple of weeks ago. She's studying these Chinalegi languages. And she actually lost her name. She's a professor at the University of Arizona. And she mentioned that there were three speakers left of the Chinalegi tribe, 4,000. They're all approaching, you know, they're late, they're old people now. One of them just recently, there was four left, and one of them recently passed away. These three, but of these three speakers, she can't seem to make them converse together. Because you have three different, one just feels like, just let it go, it's too late. Another has been sort of colonized in a way where he feels like the language is, because there's so much, I mean, you've got to also realize that the reservations, I mean, it's like everybody's trying to save us, like including very dogmatic, reborn kind of Christian activity going on. So they've somehow infected a lot of the minds of the people, and saying that they're indigenous. Way of life is the devil's way or something like that. So he equates that with language. So he won't speak it. And I forgot the third guy. She told me that this guy, she can't let them talk. She can't make them talk together. So their language is, she says, you just have to, it troubles her because she's been working with this group for a while. But I think all languages, we've been really subjected to institutional erasure of our culture. It's a reality. We are not, I guess Joy Harper said that Native people are not supposed to be here right now, which is I'm not supposed to be here right now. For years we've been eradicated, murdered, and displaced. And it's just a continuation of that. The fact that we have continued to survive is revolutionary, that I'm here to talk and speak my language. So it's an empowerment source. So it's, you know, I just stress to everybody, if you can find some sort of support network for, you know, preserving or revitalizing Native languages, you know, I would recommend that in any shape or form, any way anybody could help, because those are the languages of this continent.
Hi,
I'm
Jin Wong. I just
want to
say thank you to the panelists. One thing that I kind of want to bring to the table is this assumption of bilingualism or multilingualism, and I think I often get that a lot, and the kind of guilt that comes with that, I think, in the process of assimilation. A lot of second generation children have this kind of issue of the disconnect from hearing and speaking. So when you were talking about sounds and, you know, sound values, or that could be a word in another language, that I can hear the tonal sounds in Chinese but cannot speak. I think the issue of speaking is incredibly, you know, problematic, I think, especially if you're thinking about the kind of guilt and fear of not saying something correctly or not seeming authentic enough and the assumptions that people have with that. So I just wanted to bring that up to the table.
Yeah, no, it's a fabulously complex question, which we can only, you know, begin to get at very briefly. Is it okay if I speak first? Sorry, just jump right in there. I got this notion of, like, are you authentic enough? Like, I don't, like, too much. What we're really talking about implicitly and explicit here, you know, all afternoon is the, we're all, wherever you land on this, the kind of really slippery continuum of, there is a mother tongue to your second, third generation, and people sort of go, well, why don't you in fact speak Chinese? We've got all kinds of manipulations of that expectation of identity to language. And I understand implicitly, you know, when you say good deal, because you're trying to expect, you know, like somehow meet the expectation of why don't you, you know, and to some degree, it's going to be a fantastic political and personal burden to figure out what you do with that challenge of the feeling of guilt, because you could, in fact, learn Chinese, but would that, in fact, make it feel like you know Chinese? I'm not sure that that will solve it, because it's not something else. Okay? It's about that problem is going to lead you to some place which is not answerable by I will then master Chinese. So if you're going to have a problem, it's a wonderful burden to have. So that's what I would say initially about that. And about the best conversation I ever heard or witnessed was a mother and a daughter in a Korean restaurant sitting across the table happily eating, you know, jjajangmyeon or whatever it was. And the mother talked the entire time in Korean, the daughter talked the entire time in English. There it was, whatever that language is. Perfect communication. Yeah. So it's a great problem to have if you're going to have one linguistically.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for one more question? Okay.
Just very quickly, this is for Roberto. This week is also about the activist stance, and I heard very strongly from you that this is about a struggle, this is about hunting, this is about empowering yourself. And just quickly, do you feel that you're going to win, ultimately? Do you feel that it's a noble but worthy struggle, or does it not matter?
No, it's not that you know, I have a different perspective on preserving languages. What I do in writing in Spanish is to help Spanish die, sacrifice Spanish, to let it go. So that's reactionary, to hold it. English is gonna die.
Dying well.
Yes, that sacrifice, sacred, sacrifice.
Yeah, thank you.
So I got into English to sacrifice it.